This is Friday on the Other Side on Mind Talk. I'm your host, Dr. Pamela Brewer. Mind Talk is the show that provides you with relationship health and mental health information every day. And on Fridays, we take a look at experiences and concepts that you might not think have a mental health component, but in fact, they do.
I am very happy to introduce to you Harvard-trained pain specialist Dr. Anish Singla. He has over a decade of experience as a pain specialist, and he's here today to share his expertise and his understanding of pain and its purpose. Welcome, Dr. Singla.
Thanks so much, Pamela. I'm really excited to be on your show and excited to share some of my insights with your audience.
Well, you have recently published a book entitled Why It Hurts. Tell me why it's important to understand the purpose of pain.
Well, that's a great question, Pamela. I think that pain is one of those symptoms, one of those feelings that pretty much all of us experience at some point in our lives. And I think it's very important to understand why we have pain and how pain is actually not really always a bad thing. We experience pain in lots of situations when our bodies are potentially in danger. And for example, when you cut yourself or touch a hot object, pain is what alerts us to back away so that we can actually protect ourselves. As a pain specialist, I've encountered lots of patients who suffer with pain, and a lot of times, especially in today's society, pain is viewed as a negative thing. And you hear references to the war on pain, for example, and lots of other situations where pain is looked at as a negative experience. And what I'm trying to do is just shed some light on pain so that people can understand that, yes, it's unpleasant, but there's actually some real protection that pain provides us.
Well, excuse me, what was interesting to me early on in Why It Hurts, you make the point that over, and this number was astounding to me, over 116 million Americans suffer from chronic pain, and the treatment costs over $365 million.
Yeah.
Say more about those numbers. They just seem amazing.
Sure, absolutely. So actually, you're right. 116 million Americans do suffer with some sort of chronic pain. And actually, the number actually is even higher. It's actually $635 billion is what, you know, managing that pain costs us in this country alone every year. And so, and that's not direct medical costs. That's actually all the costs factored in. For example, medical costs plus the cost of lost productivity for missing, you know, days of work, for example, if you've got low back pain. So putting all that together, $635 billion every year for chronic pain.
It's just extraordinary. Now, you know, one of the things about chronic pain that I've seen over time is that for women who experience or report that they experience chronic pain, certainly for a while, the medical and mental health community were looking at that as essentially being all in her head.
Well, I think that, you know, there are certainly, you know, two different types of pain, and I talk about that in the book. I mean, we've got physical pain, which is what I think we all understand what physical pain is. When you stub your toe or, again, you touch a hot stove by mistake, you feel that physical sensation, and that is, and it hurts, and it causes you to back away from whatever it was that might have hurt you. But there's also another type of pain, and that's psychological pain, and it's often been referred to as an ache in the mind, as opposed to physical pain, which is more of an ache in the body. And, you know, a common situation where you might have that psychological pain would be, let's say, a situation like depression. And depression is also a very common disease that, you know, many of us in the United States, as well as the rest of the world, experience. And that in and of itself can also be interpreted as distress or pain.
Yeah, absolutely. I would certainly agree with you. Tell me about your comment that how we believe in pain is so important to the nature and the intensity of our suffering.
Yeah, that's actually a really good point, Pamela. I think that, you know, we all sort of, when we experience pain, you know, of course there's a sensation that is the pain itself, but then our thoughts around the pain are also very, very important to how we experience the pain. Again, going back to sort of the analogy of that physical injury, you know, again, stubbing your toe or touching a hot stove, you have that physical pain, but then the signal as it travels up into our brain is where we actually interpret that. And our beliefs around that are very important to how we ultimately experience that pain. And for example, if you have a certain cultural belief or a certain feeling about how that pain was how that pain occurred, you may feel much differently about it. For example, I talk a little bit about soldiers on a battlefield and some of the work of Henry Beecher in World War II. And, you know, soldiers, interestingly, that were injured on a battlefield with horrific injuries, three-quarters of them, you know, stated they had little to no pain. And it's probably because they were in an environment where they were looking at themselves as fighting a war for freedom. Whereas that same soldier in a hospital setting after they've been injured, you know, getting a simple injection of penicillin, they would scream out in terror and in pain because they're not on that battlefield anymore. So again, our experiences of how we experience the pain and how our thoughts are around the pain ultimately do influence our ultimate interpretation of the pain.
It's really fascinating how powerful, if you will, our thoughts are on our physical well-being or the lack thereof.
Absolutely. And again, I talk a little bit about how when we experience physical pain, and for example, if we experience a lot of psychological distress about that pain, for example, if you are used to being athletic and let's say playing golf or playing sports with your children, and you have some pain, for example, low back pain that might prohibit you from doing those things, the psychological feeling of well-being that you no longer are getting from those activities can weigh on you as a form of mild depression, and that can actually enhance the feeling of the pain. So there's no question that there's that connection, and the converse is also true. You know, recently, Debbie Reynolds passed away after Carrie Fisher's death, very shortly after. And for example, there's many folks who believe that she may have experienced the broken heart syndrome, mm-hmm. which, you know, in medical circles, we refer to actually as a real syndrome. It's called Takotsubo's cardiomyopathy, where intense psychological distress can actually induce a heart attack.
That is certainly a call to awareness, if you will, for folks who perhaps aren't clear about how strong the tie is between what you're thinking and believing and feeling emotionally and what you're feeling physically.
Absolutely. I think that there's more and more evidence that there is, you know, quite a connection between the physical and the psychological and how the two can play into each other.
You talk about different types of pain. Can you tell us what those three different types are?
Sure. I think that from a classification standpoint for physical pain, we usually think of pain in three separate categories. Nociceptive pain, which is simply pain that occurs due to a cut or a burn that's acute. Again, touching that hot stove, for example, would be an example of that nociceptive pain. A second type of pain is inflammatory pain, and that could be looked at as sort of the body's response, the inflammation, and part of that healing that occurs after an injury. So, for example, you touch the hot stove, you have that acute burn, but then the finger still feels kind of warm and inflamed for another week or two until things heal. And that could be looked at as an example of inflammatory pain.
I see.
And then the third type of pain that we look at is called pathological pain. And that's sort of like pain that doesn't really point you to a direction of an actual injury, but just more dysfunction of the nervous system itself. For example, if you've had a nerve that's injured, now you've got that nerve sending this signal of pain, but there's really not an acute injury that you've experienced to trigger that alarm.
So in that case, how would you treat that?
Well, you know, it's always individual. I mean, I think that first when we see a patient who comes in with a type of chronic pain that's just not getting better on its own, we have to investigate. And that investigation can involve lots of different things. For example, obviously talking about the history of how that injury or that pain may have started. We talk a little bit about we not only get the history, but we also do an examination of what the symptoms are presenting like. We may order diagnostic scans like an MRI or x-rays. And so we kind of go through that workup of that pain to really understand, you know, what's the injury if there is one, and if there's not, and now we found that there is some sort of chronic nerve injury or damage, then we sort of treat it as such. And to your question, how do we treat, for example, a patient with a chronic nerve injury? Well, you know, again, we sort of put treatment into, you know, four major categories, and medications would be one category. And within that, there's obviously many choices. There's physical therapy, which, you know, includes, you know, rehabilitation attempts to maintain function and strength. And then the third category would be minimally invasive procedures such as spinal injections or other types of nerve block procedures to try to tone down the sensitivity of the nervous system and also to serve as diagnostic measures. And then obviously the fourth option could be potentially more invasive options such as surgery.
What are your thoughts about PRP therapy, which we're hearing more and more about these days?
Absolutely. I think that PRP is a very exciting area in medicine and in pain management, because PRP is essentially taking your own cells and nutrients from your blood and extracting the real, you know, rich, the growth factors out of the platelet-rich plasma is what PRP stands for. And lots of athletes are using this to recover quicker from injuries, for example, from ankle sprains or ligamentous injuries, soft tissue types of injuries. And I think that it's very promising because it's taking your own cells, not some, you know, a drug from another, you know, that was created in the laboratory, but your own cells, and injecting them back in just to accelerate that your body's own healing process. And again, lots of athletes have been using it. You know, I myself in the book talk about how I've had a PRP and how it worked really, really well for me when I had a neck injury. And I think that it's a very exciting field. I mean, the field has actually got a name. It's called regenerative medicine, where essentially we're taking cells and nutrients and trying to regenerate parts of the body that may have undergone an injury.
You know, when you say regenerative medicine, it almost sounds like one of those things that you heard of in those science fiction movies from years ago. It just wasn't possible. It was just a made-up idea. But today it's very real and very helpful.
Absolutely. And it is very much, I mean, almost like a Star Trek kind of a phenomenon, you know, where you have, you know, these amazing cells that you can inject into your body that can sort of regenerate a damaged organ. But it's very real. You know, if you look at, for example, Ray Kurzweil, who's a big futurist and innovator, he believes that probably over the next, 10 to 20 years, that we'll be able to actually regenerate, parts of our body, like entire organs, for example, or even inject little, small nanobots, little computers in that could, do the work that we might have to do surgery to fix nowadays.
So the medical profession is certainly continually evolving and continually finding new and better and less potentially harmful in terms of the side effects ways of treating pain.
Absolutely, Pamela.
Let me ask you, when you see folks who are dealing with, for example, chronic pain, are you noticing that that is happening along particular lifestyle lines or gender lines, or does it tell me about that?
Chronic pain can really affect just about anybody. I see people from all walks of life. I see, younger folks that might have had an injury that led to chronic pain, if it was perhaps not addressed early enough. I see older folks who have a chronic medical issue just due to degeneration of the spine, for example, but they've made the choice not to, pursue surgery to fix the problem. So they sort of but they found that balance to manage the pain and decrease the pain, but also maintain function, which is sort of what our goal is with chronic pain. It's really, our goal is not zero pain when we're treating chronic pain. I mean, when we can achieve zero pain, we're very happy, and certainly we would strive for that if it's an achievable goal. But in the majority of our patients, we shoot for a goal that's perhaps a little more achievable, like, say, a 50% reduction in a patient's pain. But again, zero pain is not the goal, but avoiding zero function is the goal. So we want to keep patients functional if the pain is not, is not something we can get rid of.
I think it's so important to underscore what you just have said, that zero pain is not the goal. Because I think a lot of people who experience pain, whether it's psychological pain or physical pain, when they walk into a clinician's office, they're looking for zero pain. They're looking for a magic cure and zero pain.
That's so true, Pamela. I mean, I think that, we live in a society where, we're used to taking a pill to treat whatever ails us. For example, if you have an infection, you take some antibiotics and it's gone in a week. If you have, for example, a problem like acid reflux and you take some acid reducers, the problem goes away. But with pain, it just doesn't work that way. And I think, I suspect again that this is sort of our, body's innate wisdom protecting us, because we do need pain to survive. It is a protective alarm for our bodies. And I think that we actually have a real life example in the case of a syndrome called congenital insensitivity to pain, which unfortunately, children that are born with this, which is essentially an inability to feel pain, these children they die at a very young age because they do not have the protective alarm that pain provides us with.
Dr. Singler, we're going to take a break, but when we come back, I'd like to hear much more about the experience of not experiencing pain, because you know that there are people, I'm sure, listening who say, well, not experiencing pain ever sounds like a good deal for me. So we're going to take a break, and when we come back, we'll discuss this further.
Thanks, Pamela.
we start talking about folks who, or resume talking about folks who don't experience any pain, I wanted to go back to something that you said even before that. You made the comment that chronic pain could be impacted negatively if it's not addressed early enough. Now, in my world, which is mental health, what we will say to folks is, if you've had these symptoms for 2 weeks or more, it's really time for you to consider coming in or at least getting an evaluation. Is there a time frame in terms of chronic pain?
Well, I think that that's a great question, Pamela. I don't know that there's actually a hard and fast rule in terms of a time frame. You know, a lot of times when a person experiences an injury, let's say a simple ankle sprain or, again, a cut on the skin, those things just sort of heal themselves on their own. And so I would say that after you've had an injury, if you don't notice that that injury is getting better or improving on its own, and again, that could be days, it could be weeks, or again, if it's severe pain and it probably should get looked at much sooner, those are the situations that we really need to intervene early. So again, I would say that it's very much an individual thing, but certainly if there's pain that's severe, it should probably get looked at right away. And if it's sort of a mild or moderate pain and it's not getting better within, say, a week or 10 days, then that's probably a good time to at least start the process of having a physician evaluate that.
So it sounds like, in essence, 2 weeks for physical, for a medical issue, for pain, as well as for a mental health issue, is kind of a reasonable guideline.
I believe so. Okay. I do. And I think that it's, again, very, I mean, in situations where the pain is so severe, it's probably going to drive you to go see someone right away, like, say, the emergency room or an urgent care center. But if the pain is one of those things that you're managing, let's say, with a little bit of over-the-counter medicine, maybe some ice for an ankle sprain, and hopefully it's not a bad injury, then it's very likely that it's going to get better. But I think 2 weeks is a very reasonable number, at which point you're going to want to have that pain looked at, evaluated by a medical professional, so that you don't develop that progression to the chronic pain.
I see. Now, Anish, let's go back to the conversation we began before the break. You were talking about people who do not experience pain. And again, as I said then, there are people who are listening who are saying, wait, what? There are people who don't go through what I go through? Show me that direction to go.
That's, you know, and I can see that that would certainly be a normal response, especially for someone who, you know, is experiencing a lot of chronic pain. It would seem like that would be a great, you know, option that's available. But, you know, it's actually not. And if you look at the syndrome, it's called congenital insensitivity to pain. It's abbreviated CIP. The estimates are it affects about 1 in 25,000 people. And what ends up happening with these children, unfortunately, is they injure themselves, and they injure themselves repeatedly because they just don't know that this sharp object, for example, is bad for them. And in fact, I remember reading an article about a CIP child who had cut herself, didn't experience any pain, but then thought it was fun to sort of draw, you know, in her blood. And again, what it does is it points to the fact that pain very much is a protective function, and if you in our bodies, and if you don't have pain, you are very likely to injure yourself in ways that can then turn into very serious problems. So I think that if you look at that extreme example, you know, unless there's some other way to replace that alarm, which I don't believe there is, we do need that protective quality that pain provides us. The question is, when we have it, what do we do with it?
One of the things that strikes me as you were talking about the child who, after cutting herself and not experiencing any pain, sort of began to play with cutting herself. And I could easily see someone thinking, a child who's cutting themselves, are we looking at a case of sexual abuse? And if we're not careful and don't work to rule out any physical causes, we've got a problem.
Absolutely. And there have been cases where these CIP children are brought to the hospital from an injury, and they've suspected the parents of child abuse in some way. And until they discover that the child may have self-inflicted those wounds because the child can't feel pain, the parents, you know, sometimes are suspected of that. I know a pediatric dentist here in the local area who also has removed teeth from some of these children with CIP because they're continuously biting and causing erosions inside of their mouth from that, because they can't feel the pain from the actual injury. So again, I think that there's no question there's that protective function, and how do we manage it is really the question.
Finishing up our conversation about CIP, is there any gender impact, race, age impact? I noticed you keep talking about children.
Yeah. I mean, I think that we can see it, you know, across many cultures, many ethnicities. I don't know that there's any, specific, ethnic group that is more predisposed to it. It is fairly rare. However, there's no question that there is a genetic component to it, and I think that there is. You know, with the CIP, I mean, we've seen cases of it, you know, from all over the world, and in some cases, you know, again, it is well, many cases, it's a lethal problem. So we tend to see it in children, and I don't think that we see it in adults, because I just don't think that these children, survive long enough to become adults.
And the reason that they're not surviving is because that pain center, if you will, is not functioning, and so they can do all kinds of damage and be unaware.
Exactly.
When the source of pain is absolutely unidentifiable, certainly it's worrisome. It would be worrisome, I think, for any clinician. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, that does become a dilemma, because for example, when we can't find a physical cause for pain, we sometimes obviously, you know, throw our hands up in the air and say, well, gosh, I can't find a problem here. Does that necessarily mean that a patient is not experiencing pain? And I don't think that's the case. I think that, again, we have to understand that pain is a very complex experience. And I think that if you can't find a physical source for pain, I think the next place to look is, you know, is there something psychological that's bothering the patient? Mm-hmm. Is it something where the patient could be distressed over something happening in their life and it's manifesting as a physical symptom? And again, going back to the broken heart syndrome, for example, again, it's in many cases intense psychological distress causing a physical symptom, which is damage to the heart. So when you have a person and there is no physical injury that's identifiable, one of the things that we have to think about is, could there be some psychological distress here? And let's maybe ask some more questions along those lines.
Certainly with depression, anxiety, those kinds of experiences, it's reasonable to expect, depending on the chronicity of it, that those folks are going to be depressed. And I guess one of the questions for the clinician to be mindful of is, which predated which? Did the pain predate the depression, or did the depression flow into the pain?
Absolutely. And that's exactly why, to your point, we have to intervene early. Because if you intervene early, you're more likely to get a clearer picture of what's causing the problem. But for example, if someone is depressed for 3 months or 6 months and there's been no intervention, that depression, as you know, can start to lead to physical symptoms. For example, aches and pains in the body. And if they actually present to their doctor with aches and pains, people are probably going to start looking at a physical problem before they actually start looking at that psychological or that, you know, that mental issue, which in that case is depression.
You're right. One of your patients that you talk about, Mark, suffered from CRPS. What is that?
So that's a great question, Pamela. CRPS stands for Complex Regional Pain Syndrome. And it's a syndrome where there is a hypersensitivity to pain, usually in one of your hands or in one of your feet. And we believe, in many cases, it starts from an injury. And when that injury occurs, even though the injury may or may not have been treated, the body sort of develops this hypersensitivity to pain, where even a light touch or just touching the skin can actually evoke a serious sensation of pain. And it's a tough problem, but the good news is when we find ourselves faced with a problem like CRPS, when we intervene early and we do things to tone down the sensitivity of the nervous system, which is, in a sense, overreacting to a problem, then we can sort of tone things down and get things back, almost reboot the system with medications, physical therapy, injections, or in some case, surgery.
And after those procedures have been accomplished, does the person feel no pain, a little pain, but not as much? Or what is a reasonable expected outcome?
Sure. So the in most cases, when we intervene early, within, you know, say a few weeks of noticing the problem, I find that the patients go back to sort of their normal pain sensitivity levels. So they can still experience pain, but it's not that hypersensitivity that they were developing when they had the complex regional pain syndrome.
I see.
So it's very treatable when it's addressed early, but unfortunately, in some cases, when you don't treat it early and it goes for months or even years and then it's picked up, it's very, very hard to treat because in a sense, that hypersensitivity, you could say, has kind of become hardwired into your system.
What is the withdrawal reflex?
The withdrawal reflex is, again, it's a spinal cord mediated reflex. Going back to the example of touching a hot stove, mm-hmm. you immediately withdraw. And that withdrawal is mediated, in many cases, by pain. So it's a protective reflex that allows us to protect ourselves. And if you think back to, you know, when you may have had an injury or touched a hot object or something sharp, you back away immediately, but then just a second or two later, or a fraction of a second later, you're actually interpreting or seeing what actually happened and experiencing that in your brain.
That's common.
Yes.
Okay.
Very common. It's a common reflex, and again, it's part of that protective alarm that pain provides us with.
You know, one of the things that struck me as I was going through why it hurts, a physician's insights on the purpose of pain, not only in the way that it was written, which makes it very readable. You know, there are times when physicians or clinicians just in general write things and nobody but their professor knows what they're talking about. but this is really very readable, which I certainly appreciate. So I did want to comment on that. And the more that you explain the value of pain, you know, perhaps the less scary it is for people just in general, because it does have value.
I think it does, and I think that when you realize that it has value and that it plays an important part in preventing us from having injury, or even just sending and broadcasting an alarm signal so that we can get help when we need it, we start to realize that value, and we start to incorporate pain as just a part of life. And when you do that, I think you're going to look at it differently. You're going to look at it as a necessary part of life, something that can't just simply be shut off. And if we had the ability to shut it off, which thankfully in some cases we don't, it is important to allow us to develop and to grow and to be able to protect us from injury, but also play a part, important part in our just natural growth and wisdom.
So instead of trying to ignore the pain, which many people will do, you know, sort of push through, or be embarrassed about the pain, what we really want to do is to be curious about the pain, and that curiosity will lead us to a lot more information.
Absolutely. I think it's very important to listen to our pain. I think that it's, again, in many cases, when we experience pain from an injury that's, you know, fairly benign, like stubbing a toe or, again, just a little bit of a small cut, you know, those are signs that we have to, you know, learn how to do whatever that activity was a little bit better and smarter the next time. But when we experience something a little bit more significant, a more major trauma, and whether that's physical or psychological, we have to learn from that. We have to take that experience and say, hey, what could I have done better the next time? And when you realize that that's an essential part of that process, you start to look at it very differently.
Do you find that parents in general, if their child reports being in pain, they accept that and bring the child in, or tend to ignore it because that's what children do?
Well, I think it's very important to not ignore the pain, you know, regardless of whether it's a child or an adult. I think that when a child reports pain, we have to look at that child and sort of try to figure out what the problem is. And, you know, a common thing that I see with children is they may come in and report a tummy ache. And, you know, the question is that something physical going on? You know, did they eat something that didn't agree with them? Or do they have some kind of sensitivity to, you know, let's say a gluten sensitivity or something else that we just haven't picked up on yet? Or is it actually a psychological symptom where they're nervous about something, they're nervous about a test coming up, or they're nervous about competing in their next soccer game because it's going to be a tough match? And is that psychological distress sort of manifesting as a physical symptom? So I think it's important for parents to, you know, talk to their children to try to get a better understanding of why they're experiencing that pain. And again, hopefully it's not a serious problem. If it's something that can easily be sorted out, you know, whether it's a physical or psychological issue, I think it's important that we pay attention to that.
Anish, we're going to take a break, but when we come back, I'd like to spend a little bit more time focusing on the psychological aspects of pain and the impact of how one feels on how one thinks. We'll be right back.
Thank you.
Dr. Singla, you talk about some of the findings as a result of functional MRIs. First of all, I'd like for you to explain what that means, and then we'll talk a little bit more about what some of those findings have been.
Absolutely, Pamela. That's a great question. So functional MRI is a tool that's primarily used in a research setting at the present time where we can use an image, the amount of blood flow and changes in blood flow to different regions of the brain. And we use that as a measure to tell us how activated a certain region of our brain is becoming. And we've, in a lab setting, we've looked at both physical and psychological pain and tried to induce it through some sort of a controlled stimulus, like, say, a small electric shock. And then we've looked at functional MRIs and tried to map out what areas of the brain are becoming more active or stimulated. So it's a very important early way of trying to measure with a scan what parts of our brain are becoming more active when we experience pain.
And you say that the evidence shows that physical pain and emotional pain activate the same regions in the brain. What does that mean? Why is that important?
Well, I think it's a very interesting and exciting area where there is a lot of research. And what is fascinating to me is that there is quite a bit of overlap between when we experience physical pain and when we experience psychological pain, because overlapping brain regions for both of those experiences are stimulated under functional MRI. So one could actually argue the fact that those same regions, those overlapping regions, are becoming stimulated with both those types of pain, that psychological pain is real pain.
That psychological pain is real pain. Again, I think we're getting better at understanding that. Perhaps we have a little way to go with that. But let me ask you this. You give several examples in which the person's psychological mindset had a tremendous impact on the pain. You say that feeling calm and supported can actually lessen the response to physical pain. So does that mean that if somebody's in pain and perhaps a loved one pays particular attention to them, that that pain, in fact, will be experienced to a lesser degree?
Absolutely. I believe that when we have pain, again, we're broadcasting that, and it's sort of a distress signal, not only for ourselves, but for those around us. And when others come to our attention and are supportive and caring for us, that it certainly plays a role in lessening that psychological impact of the pain. And our body does have ways of modulating those pain sensations, for example, through mindfulness and some of the interesting research coming out with the impact of mindfulness on the effects of pain. We can see, again, because of that overlap between physical and psychological pain and the interrelationship, that by feeling calm and supported and being able to have positive thoughts about the pain or the outcome of the pain, we can actually lessen the experience of that pain.
It really is extraordinary and certainly underscores the mind-body connection in a significant way.
Absolutely. I think that there's no question that there is a connection between the mind and the body. And again, we see that with the effects of certain syndromes, as I alluded to earlier, with the Takotsubo syndrome being an extreme manifestation of psychological distress causing a physical problem. And again, we talked a little bit about physical problems and how we emotionally or how we think about those problems can you know, cause our pain to go up a notch or even decrease if you feel calm and supported.
One of the things that I found very interesting in, quite frankly, this very interesting book that you've written is when you talked about the fact that a study in pain medication indicated that during texting, during a surgical procedure with either a stranger or a friend resulted in less pain. You know, the idea of texting during a surgical procedure in and of itself can kind of pull you up short because you don't really think about that. But then when you talk about the fact that texting during surgery can actually help reduce the pain, you got to help me out here.
That's a, you know, it was a great study, and I am happy to go into that in more detail. I think what was interesting about the study in pain medicine was the fact that these patients, and again, remember, these were not major surgical procedures where they were under general anesthesia. Of course, they had to be awake, and a lot of times they were under some sort of regional anesthesia, but that still doesn't mean that they're not experiencing some amount of pain or pressure. And I think that what it points to is the fact of how distraction can actually help lessen pain. What's interesting is the group that was texting a friend or texting a stranger had significantly less requirements for pain medications during the surgery. And I think that what was even more interesting is that there appeared to be a difference, more of a difference, less pain medicine with the stranger than with the friend. And what I probably think, and they don't go into too much detail in the study about why, but what I think may have played a role there is when you're talking to a stranger, you know, in normal everyday conversation, they're usually trying to ask you get to know you questions. For example, you know, what are your hobbies and, you know, what kinds of things do you like to do? Whereas a friend might be kind of asking you questions that are more routine, like sort of, hey, what time are we going to meet for dinner? And so the degree of the distraction with the stranger might have been more, and perhaps that's why people were perceiving less pain during those surgeries.
It really is fascinating. And you also say that video games reduce pain. What type of video games?
That's a great question. I think that certainly studies have looked at this, and what seems to be, again, playing a role is the distraction element with the video game. When you're immersed in any other activity, whether it's a video game or whether it's reading a book, you're thinking less about your pain. And so you're probably filtering out some of that pain through a distraction method. Even in children after surgery, when we don't want to necessarily give them lots of pain medications which can result in side effects, we'll sometimes sit them down and have them play video games and they actually have less pain. So I think that there's a lot of modulation that's probably occurring when you're distracted by an activity that just simply allows you to perhaps block it out to some degree.
Can I guess accurately that it needs to be a nonviolent video game, or does that matter?
That's a good question. I don't know that that's actually been studied or looked at, but I certainly would agree with your premise there. And for example, with virtual reality, if someone has a burn injury and they're being shown a cold or a snow-filled landscape, they're more likely to think less about the burning sensation. So I would agree with you that if you're playing a game that's a little bit less violent, that you're probably not going to have as much of the feeling of someone getting hurt and that potentially amplifying your pain.
What is mirror therapy?
Mirror therapy is something that we've used in the setting of a patient with a amputated limb. And what happens with mirror therapy, which is fascinating, particularly with a syndrome called phantom limb syndrome or phantom pain syndrome, which essentially is someone experiencing pain in a limb or an extremity that doesn't exist. And you might ask, well, how can someone actually have pain where there is no physical limb?
Mm-hmm.
And again, it points to that sort of whole thing about how pain is eventually interpreted in our brain. And our brain has this sort of spatial representation called a homunculus for our entire body. So it sort of knows where our hands and our feet and parts of our body are. And so if you do happen to have an amputation, and let's say you don't have a right leg, your brain still thinks it's there. And if you experience pain in, for example, the stump where the nerves may have been cut from that amputation, and then you're getting that symptom of feeling like there's pain in the leg, and it's obviously occurring somehow centrally, when you use mirror therapy, what it's doing is it's actually sort of flip-flopping and making you think that the right side is actually the left and the left is the right. And when you see in the mirror that you're actually moving the right leg, which has been amputated because you're actually moving your left leg, it actually will decrease your sensation of pain. And I think, again, it points to that whole idea of certain pain being interpreted centrally in our brains. So seeing the limb, it's there, I have less pain.
Interesting. I mean, it really is fascinating. Opiates, do they make pain worse or do they actually help?
Well, I think that you can see both situations with opiates. In a majority of situations, when opiates are used after an acute trauma or after surgery, they actually can help pain quite a bit. And they are a lot of times used in when we have a serious injury. And I think it's very reasonable to do that. But I think when you get into a situation where you're using them for chronic pain, they don't always help us to the same degree. And there is a paradoxical phenomenon that has occurred and does occur in patients that use opiates for chronic pain, and that is a situation called opiate hyperalgesia, where paradoxically using more and more opiates can help sort of drive us to experience more pain. And I suspect that it's the body trying to preserve that protective reflex that we have, that protective alarm that we have experiencing as pain.
It's really fascinating. You know, the idea that there is so much to really think about. Pain is not something to be, clearly, it's not something to be afraid of or ignored. It's really something to do a significant amount of research, recognizing that there is often a tremendous tie between the psychological and the physical.
Absolutely. And I think that where pain is where we sort of see the real advantage of pain as clinicians, as physicians, we look at when someone has pain, let's follow that pain and let's try to understand where that pain is coming from. And if that person wasn't experiencing pain in a particular pattern, for example, sciatica from a herniated disc, it would be a lot harder to trace that back to the actual problem. So I think where we find that pain does help us as doctors is when someone presents with a certain pattern of pain. It could be primary pain, it could be some referred pain, again, sciatica down the leg. We have to look at that symptom, trace it back, and use it as sort of a path that we follow to find the underlying problem. And when we treat the underlying problem, and hopefully it gets better, then that pain served its purpose. But in the situation where pain is ignored, for example, and then the problem becomes more chronic, it becomes much, much harder to treat.
Dr. Anish Singla is a pain management professional. He has also written Why It Hurts, A Physician's Insights on the Purpose of Pain. Dr. Singla, thank you so much for this book and for your time today.
Thank you, Pamela.
And Dr. Singla, is there a website for the book?
Absolutely. It's called www.whyithurtsbook.com. And you'll get more information about the book, and it's also available for ordering on Amazon.com.
All right, so the website is whyithurtsbook.com.
Yes, that's correct.
Terrific. Thank you again very much.
Thank you, Pamela.
And folks, thank you for joining me on this edition of Mind Talk. Mind Talk is brought to you daily as an educational public service, and it is not intended to replace any work that you might choose to do with a licensed medical, mental health, or other professional. Mind Talk is produced by Jim Brown and 26x2 Communications, and it is available to you on demand 24/7 by going to myndtalk.org, or you can simply go to iTunes and download the Mind Talk app. If you would like to be in touch with me directly, you can send an email to pamela@mindtalk.org. That is a confidential email address. Only I will see it. So again, that's pamela@myndtalk.org. And folks, remember always, if it's unacceptable, well, it's unacceptable. Take care.